Soon after I became a freelance, I walked into the bar in Lime Grove where people assembled to drink and gossip. Hugh Weldon was there. He had just been put in charge of all documentaries. He hailed me. Did I want to go to Japan? Yes, of course. Next week? Certainly. What's the story? He explained that the London Symphony Orchestra was going there on tour. It would be the first time a whole European orchestra had given concerts in Japan. Their manager had chartered a jet, and there were four spare seats. It broke his heart to see them going to waste, so he had offered them to the BBC in return for making a film about the whole event. There must be a story there somewhere, Hugh said. I agreed. What it was, I couldn't be sure at the moment, but I felt certain that something would emerge as we went along. The opportunity was in any case not one to be refused. It was not only that visiting Japan would be exciting, so would be the chance to see what went on behind the scenes in classical music. My cameraman was to be Ken Higgins. He had been a news cameraman during the war and had carried his ancient Newman Sinclair 35mm camera across Burma with the Chindits. Now he was one of the star staff cameramen. He had the reputation of chewing up inexperienced or indecisive directors and spitting out the pieces. I was not certain how far my experience of making films with monkeys was going to take me with him. The long flight to Japan gave me the chance to meet the orchestra's players. They were as baffled as I was about the kind of film that should be made. Some suggested it might be a travelogue about Japan, intercut with short excerpts from their concerts. Others were apprehensive that it might be an embarrassing exposé of the swashbuckling life led by orchestral musicians when out on a tour. I suggested, somewhat tentatively, that we might film during rehearsals. "You ought to get a few fireworks from one of the maestros," said one of them. "A bit of an argument about interpretation, that sort of thing. Several of them who are coming with us have short fuses. We could get one of them going in a rehearsal if that would suit you." In truth, I didn't know what I wanted. Perhaps the film should contain bits of all these ingredients. One thing was certain. We would need sizable chunks of at least one concert performance. This was not going to be easy to film with only one camera. We would not be allowed to move around during the concert itself. The only solution, therefore, was to film the same piece during several performances, each time from a different point of view. Then, using one master soundtrack, we could cut the pictures together. Fortunately, a number of works were being played several times, so that this was possible. I decided that one of the major excerpts would come from the last movement of Tchaikovsky's Fourth Symphony, which Antal Dorati was conducting. The first concert was in Osaka. The Tchaikovsky Symphony formed the second half. Ken and I sat in a box. He said that he would need prompting about what to film when, so in the relative privacy of the box, I was able to whisper and point, and all was well. We had star conductors: Pierre Monteur, magisterial and imperturbable; George Schulte, sometimes conducting with electrical energy, sometimes with no more than a rhythmic wriggle of one wrist; and Dorati, occasionally baffling the orchestra with Englished versions of his native Hungarian, such as, "While the going is good, you make mistake, and then it's too late." We filmed the principals of the orchestra giving masterclasses to Japanese instrumentalists and post-concert celebrations with Dorati and Schulte, fellow Hungarians, boisterously singing songs of their native country together at the piano, and the whole orchestra responding with the virtuoso version of Old MacDonald Had a Farm. The final concert was to take place in Tokyo. We had now filmed the last movement of the Tchaikovsky Symphony four times, concentrating in turn on the brass, the strings, the woodwind, and the percussion. They would all cut together nicely. But one crucially important element was missing: the conductor face on. Sitting in the dark at the back of the hall, or in a box reserved for us, we and our camera, so far, had been relatively unobtrusive. But there was only one place from which to get proper face-on coverage of Maestro Dorati conducting, and that was in the orchestra itself. To sit there would require the permission of the Japanese concert promoters. The thought appalled them. There was much intaking of breath and hissing in horror. Out of the question. For one thing, our camera would make too much noise, and if we sat in the orchestra with their microphones adjusted to capture its every sound, the noise of the camera directly in front of them would be heard on the radio relay. I assured them that our camera was one of the quietest in existence. Indeed, to all intents and purposes, it was totally silent. This was not strictly truthful, but I felt able to exaggerate just slightly, for I didn't intend to start filming until the last few minutes of the last movement, when every instrument of the orchestra was playing at full throttle. Under those circumstances, no one could possibly hear any camera. After much persuasion, permission was reluctantly given. The symphony formed the second half of the concert. After the interval, Ken and I, in our best suits, silently filed onto the platform with the French horns and took our place alongside them. The camera, draped with all the cloth we could find to muffle its sound, stood alongside Ken like some unfamiliar addition to the percussionist's battery. Ken focused it on the podium and locked it off. All he had then to do was unobtrusively to reach up and press the start button. He wasn't sure of the right point to do this, but I knew the symphony well, particularly after having sat through four performances of it so recently, so I would give him a nudge. We sat with folded arms and appropriately solemn expressions throughout the exposition of the themes and their elaboration and combination. The music slowly built up towards its final climax. The strings were playing furiously. The trombones brayed and the French horns alongside chorused in an ear-spitting response. I gave Ken an unobtrusive nudge and he reached up and turned on the camera. Maestro Durati was at his most athletic, urging the orchestra on to a huge climax. But then, instead of the repeated thunderous final chords I'd expected, a sudden hush fell on the orchestra. An oboe played a long, plaintive phrase over soft pizzicato from the strings, accompanied by the grinding noise of our camera. I'd forgotten that the last section of the movement was repeated before it came to its final climactic bars. Ken and I sat there perspiring, pretending that we had nothing to do with the black shape audibly growling beside us. It seemed an age before its noise was once again drowned by that of the orchestra. Relief. But only a short-lived one, for now I had another worry. I had started the camera far too early. It was essential that we filmed the final bars and saw Maestro Durati lay down his baton and turn to the audience. Would we run out of film before that happened? We reached the final bars, and with all the noise and the tumult of applause that followed them, Ken couldn't tell from the camera's sound whether it had run out or not. Back in the cutting room in London, I waited anxiously for that shot. Durati laid down his baton and turned to the audience, and the film came to an end. It was a dead heat. But by that stage, I was able to cut to a shot of the audience applauding, taken at a previous concert. Now, however, I had a further problem. By the time the camera approached the very end of its magazine, the battery, close to exhaustion, was having to pull a heavy load of film, so it was running slightly slowly. That meant that when the film was shown at the proper speed, Maestro Durati appeared to be whirling his arms like a demented windmill. But I had no other shot to use. In the editing room, I timed it so that he laid his baton down at exactly the same time as the music finished on the master soundtrack. But in consequence, his last frantic gestures bore little relation to the rhythm of the music. Would the maestro's agent think that the result was libelous? I decided to invite several members of the orchestra to have a preview of the finished film. They showed every sign of enjoying it, nudging one another when one of them appeared in shot and making ribald remarks about sections of the performances. At the end, I asked them if they'd seen any musical faults. None. What about Dorata's gestures at the end? Weren't they out of time with the music? Oh, don't take any notice of that, they said. We don't. He always gets a little excited in the final bars.